Because in my view, the global economy is not doing well. So based on the real economy, on what is happening on the ground, maybe interest rates are about where they should be. But the financial markets are in the sky. The bond market has retreated, but it's still relatively high. Given the current rate of cost of living increases, in my view, interest rates should be higher, not.
Dr. Mark Faber, good evening to you. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm in the north of Thailand, in the Golden Triangle, and the weather is rather nice. I mean, it's not cold.
Nice. Well, it's we've been having fluctuations of cold and warm weather here in the southeast of the U.S., where I'm at, in Georgia, just northeast of Atlanta. Really, thank you so much for coming on. I wanted to get to it and see, really talk about 24 in review. What surprised you? And yeah, just your thoughts at the end of the year here.
Well, it may sound funny, but like every year, it surprises me how much money is being essentially printed and what liquidity is being made available, and therefore how much stock prices are going up irregularly. Some markets have performed very well, whereas other markets haven't done all that well. But in general, stock investors who were, say, in U.S. equities have done very well. And also in some commodities, people have done well. In the precious metals, silver, gold, and in coffee, which is up like 84% this year. There's also the question about interest rates and inflation going forward. Because as you know, we had an inflationary bout into 2022, and then after 2022, inflation cooled down. But not as much as maybe some policymakers had expected. And there's a big question mark whether interest rates should be cut or not. In my view, they shouldn't be cut. But here we have the dilemma that characterizes the economic environment. When you have monetary inflation, the problem is that the monetary inflation distorts many economic issues and factors. So what you have is essentially in the present environment of loose monetary policies, they're loose. We have asset price inflation, notably in financial assets, and as I mentioned, in precious metals. But the real economy, if you analyze it solidly, not based on government statistics, it shows that the majority of households isn't doing particularly well worldwide because cost of living increases are higher than the wage or earnings increases. So you split the world into two classes, the asset holders, which have become wealthier in 2024, including Mark Fab, although I disapprove with the monetary policies. But the ordinary people that don't have assets, they are actually being hurt. And in some cases, if you look at the statistics about how many people live paycheck to paycheck, it's at the highest level ever. If you look at the statistic like affordability in housing in America, it's at the lowest level ever. This is a consequence of loose monetary policies. It distorts the entire economic picture, with some sectors staying depressed or actually moving into sort of a depression, and other sectors booming, like asset prices.
So do you see this disparity here between people that own assets and, if you would, the middle class or people that don't? Do you see that this has led to the upheaval in Europe? For example, Germany and France, just to name two countries, have really just imploded as far as politically speaking. Do you see that as the reason? And do you see that spreading even more in 25?
There are many reasons why Europe is doing so badly. Partly because, and this has been observed in the economic theory a long time ago, you basically have inflation because of monetary policies that are loose, but equally important are fiscal policies by the government. In other words, when the government spends too much money and doesn't collect enough in taxes, and in fees and so forth, you have a fiscal deficit, a budget deficit. And the budget deficit is essentially excessive spending by the government. But instead of increasing taxation or cutting spending, the government then goes and borrows money. As a result of that, the government debt goes up. And in time, I mean, not immediately, but in time, the increased interest payments on the debt by the government retards economic growth. What also retards economic growth is the expansion of the government. The government is unproductive. The productive sector is the private sector, the personal the individual initiative and not the government. And so you have essentially a slowdown in economic growth and a pickup in inflation. And this is happening at the present time. And I'm afraid that the pickup in inflation and in the fiscal deficits is actually brought about, especially in democracies. Because in democracies, all the measures that lead to inflation, namely, the people say the government should do this, the government should help here, the government should subsidize here, the government should enact tax cuts and so forth and so on. All the measures that lead to inflation are actually very popular, politically seen. You understand? And what is unpopular, namely tightening the belt, increasing taxation, and so forth, that the public doesn't want. So in a democracy, people essentially punish themselves. They don't realize it, but they punish themselves, the majority. In Europe, we have, in addition to all this, we have incompetent politicians that are from the Green Party, and very left-wing politicians that are not interested in economic growth, but are driven by policies of envy and essentially destroying accumulated wealth by the wealthy people. This is one of the tenets of the Marxist socialist ideology. You bring down wealth. You take wealth away from the rich because these are perceived as pigs, and you try to redistribute it, usually not to the people, but to the politicians. That is essentially the socialist ideology. And then we have in Europe, even more so than in the U.S., this absurd immigration policy, where entire regions in Germany, France, Italy, and so forth, they're controlled by immigrants, mostly refugees, and they are you know, there are many books that have been written about immigration. Say, in the 19th century, why did people move to America? The American population was 4 million in 1800 and 80 million in 1900. Why did people move to America? Because social conditions were far better in America than in Europe. And so they moved there and they were prepared to work and hustle and essentially build the future. But today's refugees, I'm not saying everyone, but most of them, they come because of social security contributions that they can get and advantages that they can get. And they, in most cases in Europe, I haven't calculated it in the US, but in Europe, the refugees cost a lot of money for the government. And certainly in the first few years, and I suppose also in the years thereafter.
Yeah.
We have to distinguish. It's like I mentioned in the introduction, the economies in Europe are not doing well, but the stock markets have actually done rather well.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I was looking at charts, and I look at charts all day, as you do. It's just about when the big economies, the U.S. and Europe and China, we're at highs for the year, and in the U.S., we're at all-time highs. And so my question really is, do you expect any kind of austerity in 25, or do you expect continually money printing and social programs again, to fuel inflation that seems to be making its way into asset prices?
Yes, that's what I expect, more price increases. But as you know, the Trump administration has said they will do this and they will do that. And there are different views on whether it can be done. The one thing I can guarantee you, in America, they cannot cut government expenditures as much as they predicted. It's impossible, because a lot of government expenditures must be met, like Social Security and Medicare and so forth. So the items that can be cut are far too small that it could have a huge impact.
Got it. So do you expect, again, going into 25, just this inflationary pressure that we've seen in really for the past several years, and maybe it really hit it when 24, but you expect the same thing?
But I'd like to say this. The picture is murky because in my view, the global economy is not doing well. So based on the real economy, on what is happening on the ground, maybe interest rates are about where they should be. But the financial markets are in the sky. The bond market has retreated, but it's still relatively high. Given the current rate of cost of living increases, in my view, interest rates should be higher, not at a touch above 4% on the 10-year U.S. Treasury. And in Germany, we have interest rates, say, around 2% on the 10-year. But the cost of living are going up by more than 2% per annum, in my view. And I've seen insurance premiums increases, you know, for people. They are serious. I mean, someone sent me a letter. She has a care program for old age, you know. Her premium go up by 99% in 3 years. And that is being felt by a lot of households. Also, car insurance, house insurance, home insurance, all these items go up quite a lot. Now, for the rich people, say, if it touches me, it's not a disaster. But for people who live essentially almost paycheck to paycheck already, it puts them in an uncomfortable position. And we have evidence from supermarket chains and so forth, like Dollar Tree and Target and so forth. They all say that actually ordinary people are cutting down on necessities. They're not cutting down on luxuries. Yeah. Tells you something about the state of the economy. And I guarantee you, this is the pattern of inflation. In inflationary times, the middle class and the lower classes get hurt very badly. The rich people, and I mean, I don't have a social agenda against rich people. I'm also wealthy. But I'm trying to explain that the monetary inflation is some sort of a crime. It is a crime against humanity because it hurts the vulnerable people, whereas we, the more powerful people and the more affluent people, actually benefit from inflation, monetary inflation. And that creates a very poor social environment, which then leads to political problems.
Yes, and that's what really what you're seeing a lot right now, especially in Europe, correct?
Yes. I mean, this is in Europe. The mood is rather negative. But it's been also fostered by the government officials. And you ask yourself, from who gives them the orders to these government officials? What? They can't be this stupid. Someone must tell them, you have to adopt these policies and so forth and so on. So that, I don't know who is behind what people normally call the deep state. We all know that the deep state exists, but we don't know precisely who is the deep state, who gives the orders.
Yeah, I've actually thought a lot about that because I believe in the deep state, but I don't know who the deep state is. I can't define specifically the deep state or just point out to the person who the deep state is.
He's Scepter, like the James Bond movie, Scepter. You don't know exactly who is behind it, but they're everywhere.
Last time I had you on, you made a comment that really stuck out with me. You said you expected it, I'm paraphrasing, but over the next few years or several years that the bond yields on the 10 would hit 20%, that you wouldn't be, I don't want to say you expected that, but you wouldn't be surprised by that. And I was actually, right before I had you on, I was looking at the 10-year, and I was looking at a 10-year chart, and we are at 10-year highs on bond yields. Do you expect that to continue, if you would, going on over the next year and really over the next several years?
In my mind, it's likely to continue, and I want to explain precisely why.
Please.
Let's assume the economy is weaker. Say the Chinese economy is relatively weak. It's not as weak as the Western media portrays it to be. The Western media and the Western politicians, for some reason, they hate China. Hate. Whereas 5 years ago, they were applauding China and its achievements and so forth. Nowadays, they hate China, partly because China has overtaken the world in many industries. That should be clear, that nowadays, companies from the West, they don't go to China for cheap labor. Labor is cheaper in hundreds of other countries in the world. But they go to China because of the technology and the know-how. In many fields, whether it's chemical engineering or mining engineering, China has the top universities in the world, the top, the first 5-10 best universities in scientific research are usually Chinese universities, with one exception, MIT. But the others are mostly Chinese universities that the media never tells the people in the Western world. And of course, in China and in India, They're, I mean, together, China and India, they produce a million scientists a year. How many scientists a year does Switzerland produce? 200. You understand? We're talking about big numbers. And the media portrays China very negatively. Now, I need to add one point, since you are also an investment channel. The Chinese stock market and the Hong Kong stock market, and believe me, I have the name Dr. Doom. It came in Hong Kong because I was bearish about Hong Kong for many years. Now, I think there's value in Hong Kong and Chinese stocks. I mean, the market has gone up actually a lot since July. We were down by more than 10% in the first few months of 2024. And then we shot up dramatically. Now we've been consolidating, but I think the market will continue to go up for a variety of reasons. And my view about, you know, if you look forward to 2025, I think we have this huge gap in the valuation of U.S. assets, the FANG stocks, the Magnificent Seven, and then you have Europe and the emerging markets at historical low levels relative to the U.S. And also commodity-related stocks, they're very low relative to the Magnificent Seven and semiconductor stocks. This is where I see some value. Like in Japan, 1989, the valuation of Japan was astronomical, and the Japanese market cap as a percent of the world was 50%. In other words, a country with 100, at the time they had 125 million people, was worth 50% of global stock market capitalization. Now the U.S. is close to 60% of global stock market capitalization. Now, I understand all the arguments why NVIDIA should be at a high level and so forth. But all I can say is there are statistics that we can look up that show that the highest market cap stocks in the long run, say 10, 20 years, do not outperform the market, period. So they shouldn't have a premium to the rest of the market. So you know, when people ask me about 2025, we have to be very specific. Some things are cheap and they will go up, and other things are very expensive and they'll go down. Now, I concede that both could go down, but the cheap ones may go down less than the expensive ones. Like March 2000 was the peak of the Nasdaq. All stocks went down afterwards to 2001, 2002. And then some stocks, the resource stocks, the gold shares, started to move up. Gold started to run up after 2001. But the leaders of the bubble, the dot-com stocks, they didn't move much. And very few stocks have made new highs. At the time, the most popular stock was Cisco. The whole world was going to use Cisco servers and so on. And the stock, even today, is lower than it was in 2000. Intel is lower than in 2000. This is the beauty of the stock market. The rules of the game change occasionally, and they change when the whole world understands the rules. When the whole world is long stocks, something will happen, and stocks will underperform other investment themes and assets, investment asset.
Okay, so when you mentioned Hong Kong and China, where you were bullish, relatively speaking.
Yes.
Where else do you see value for investors? And also on that note, gold is so high right now, do you still see value in gold as well as the gold equities?
The gold question is maybe easier to answer, but it's so complex because you and I, we could say, and this is another feature of monetary inflation. It's very difficult to establish value. You know, I mean, I could say gold is cheap compared to NVIDIA, or gold is cheap compared to all the monetary reserves in the world, to all the stock market capitalizations in the world, all the bond market capitalizations, you know, it was all financial assets. I take an ounce of gold, I can say the whole financial system is not backed by an ounce of gold. Where, say, in 1970, gold was more important as a percent of the global financial system. And I can also say, okay, 1970, the gold price is 35 ounces, $35 per ounce. And now it is 2,660, whatever. So I could argue my purchasing power of money has been maintained in gold. So gold is not particularly cheap, maybe not particularly expensive, but as a store of value, gold functioned relatively well. Say, if you went on a holiday in 1970 and you come back today, if you had all your money in gold, your purchasing power has been maintained. In all assets, this has been the case. You know, if you bought the property in Chicago in the wrong area, it's not worth very much anymore.
Right.
I would say gold. I would still buy gold as a store of value. I wouldn't necessarily buy it as a huge, but I've never bought gold as a huge asset of appreciation. But huge appreciation, I choose other things, you know, things that are truly depressed and also higher risk.
So what assets, other areas, divorcing gold for a moment, what areas do you see value right now? You mentioned China and Hong Kong.
Yes, good question. I mean, I give you specifically the ideas because I look after portfolios and I invest essentially globally. So it's not popular right now, but I think there's some value in Brazil. I own some Brazilian banks and I own Petrobras. And I have bonds of Braskem. And then I have Bank of Colombia, Banco Colombia. The Colombian market is obviously not popular at the present time. But I'd like to introduce a thought to your viewers. People always say, I want to buy low and sell high. That is the idea. And what happens? They buy high and sell low. If something is inexpensive, if something is a bargain, it has to have a problem. Otherwise, it will never be a bargain. So I like markets like Colombia and Banco Colombia. They will, the dividends are probably around 8-9% per annum. I also own Banco Chile. I think it's a valuable country. And by the way, when people talk about failed states, I want to tell you a story. Thailand is considered by economic and social experts as a failed state, okay? But why do so many tourists come to Thailand and love the country? And why do so many retirees come to Thailand and retire in Thailand if it's a failed state? Maybe we have to adjust. the definition of what is a failed state. Maybe we Western democracies are failed state. If I look at Europe nowadays, even Switzerland, I always think when I'm in Europe, I want to go back to Thailand. This is not my world anymore. But seriously. Anyway, so I also have this Banco Chile. And then I have Bank of Cyprus. The bank wasn't bust. The customers went bust. Their deposits became worthless. This is another issue that we have to consider. If someone tells me, oh, I don't trust the stock market, I put all my money on deposits. Well, the deposits are no longer safe the way they were safe in the 50s and 60s. And then I own a Bank of Georgia. The very good, over the years, have been a very good investment. And then I own something special, is Bank Halyk in Kazakhstan.
The oil plant?
And I'm considering buying Uzbekistan Fund. The Uzbekistan Fund is run by my friend at the Asian Financial Services. The market sells for about 4 times earnings in Uzbekistan.
Wow.
So if you ask me, there are opportunities, but they're not opportunities where you put all your money. You understand? You spread it and you hope you have one big winner.
Right. Talk to me a little bit about in 25, specifically about the U.S. The last time we'd spoken, you were on record as saying you would expect the policies to be of the Trump administration to be inflationary. And again, I just want to get clarity on this. You're not expecting anything different than what you said previously. And what's the risk to the downside of the U.S. economy? Is it still the debt and the bond market with higher yields?
Yes, I think that's... But the difficulty is the government can show that GDP is going up, and the reality is that the standards of living of 80% of the people is going down. But nominal GDP is going up. That's what I'm telling you. In monetary inflationary times, everything gets distorted, and the public reads in the newspaper GDP is up, and they are struggling and tightening their belts because they can't meet their payments. And they ask themselves, well, what's wrong? The wives go to the husband and say, you idiot. GDP is up and your salary is down.
Got it. Well, any final thoughts that you'd want to leave our viewers here going into the new year?
I mean, I'm an economist and a strategist. And we have to be humble in life and modest. I think we know actually, and I read a lot. The whole day I spend collecting information because I publish my newsletters and so forth, and I write myself, and I consider myself to be reasonably well informed, both geopolitically and historically and economically and financially. Because from the day I was a young boy, I like to look at the results of bicycle races and sports events. And now I just like to look at how stocks perform in the market. So I'm actually a veteran investor that still looks at individual stocks essentially the whole night. But my view is that we know about the present very little, about the current situation. We know, we know from historians about the past, but the historians, they were all biased. They were either, left leaning or right leaning, or they were French. The French, of course, portrayed Napoleon very differently than a Russian historian. And the same about the Second World War. We have different interpretations and different views. But the future, we know really nothing. We know nothing. I mean, I tell you, when I grew up, and I started in 1970 on Wall Street, we had one of the leading photographic analysts of Wall Street, Brenda Lee Laundrie. And she predicted that the Chinese would buy this and that many pictures from Polaroid and this and that many films from Kodak and this and that and so on. None of these very brilliant photo analysts, photography analysts, ever thought that you and I would take pictures from a mobile phone. And that this would essentially, and electronically, and that this would essentially put out of business Polaroid and Kodak.
Yeah.
I mean, this is amazing. And I've seen it. And, the projections about how many pictures the Chinese would take were underestimating by millions of times. Young people take 100 pictures a day.
Right. Yeah, this really hard.
I don't even know where to press on my phone. I just use it for calling emergency.
Yeah, you sound like me.
Well, Dr. Mark Faber, I think we'll end on that. I want to thank you so much for your time. You're one of the more popular guests we have. And
bad sign to be popular in life.
It is. But you have that in my book, and I just I'm very grateful to always spend time with you. So I just want to thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I wish you and all your viewers a wonderful festive season, Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year, full of financial success.
And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year back to you. Take care.
Thank you.
Be in touch. Take care.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Take care.